Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
That new safe software attestation rule from the Homeland Security Department has become final. Contractors have to start planning now for when the rule goes into effect this fall. Here with more on how to ensure compliance, Haynes Boone procurement attorney Dan Ramish. And Dan, let's start with your sense of whether software vendors are even aware of this or onto this whole thing.
Well, Tom, part of the challenge here is that the software that's covered is very broad. It's not just prime contractors that are selling software to the government, but it seems pretty clear that this will be required of software producers anywhere in the supply chain. And some of those companies may not even be aware that they're selling to the federal government. So it seems as though not all software producers that will need to comply with these requirements appreciate that they are upon them now with the attestation form now hitting the streets in final form.
And here's a question. What about firmware? I mean, if you buy a printer today, it's a full-blown computer with a hard drive and connectivity, and you can convert documents into texts and email them from a printer, all this kind of jazz. Would that be covered, I wonder?
Yes, firmware, operating systems, applications, cloud-based software. It even covers actually products that contain software. So very broad in scope. The only limit is that there's a time cutoff, September 14, 2022, or more recent than that, if the software has been released or if a major version has been released, the software will be covered. And then there are some exceptions for software developed by federal agencies or open source software or third party open source and proprietary components that are incorporated. It's only software end products that need to be subject to the attestation requirements.
All right. And then so this goes into effect precisely when? I mean, the rule's finalized, but I think there's a little bit of prep time.
Yeah. So technically, there are either 3 or 6 months after the OMB approval of the final common form from CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. And the exact date, they didn't nail that down when they issued it, as is not uncommon. The form came out on March 11th, but it was dated March 8th. So exactly where you're measuring from is not totally clear, but it'll be for critical software producers sometime in June, in early June, and then September for all other software producers.
And will this take the form of a FAR clause or a clause in contracts that the government issues?
So that's a good question. There is a FAR rulemaking in process. It's FAR case 2023-02. And there was an update in a recent publication noting that the CAC chair sent the draft proposed FAR rule to OIRA. So the rule is going to come in short order, I think. It probably will be a proposed rule, but that will formally implement this in contracts to contractors. And there will very likely be a flow down requirement.
And a big question, I think, on a lot of contractors' minds is, will this have the implications of False Claims Act violations if your attestation is there, but there's something wrong with your software, or your software is fine, but you didn't attest properly?
Yes, it's going to be very important to accurately and truthfully attest to the requirements. So it actually mentions right on the form that providing false or misleading information may be a violation of the Criminal False Statements Act if that is knowing and willful. There's also a DOJ civil cyber fraud initiative that's been going on since 2021 that's specifically trying to crack down on government contractors failing to meet cybersecurity requirements, bringing False Claims Act investigations and enforcement actions.
We were speaking with Dan Ramish, a procurement attorney with Haynes Boone. And notwithstanding false claims, there might be other penalties in here, which we'll get to. But has anyone thought about the question of, if you attest to the safety of your software and can prove that, to your best knowledge, the attestation was accurate, and somebody hacks the software anyway, what happens?
Well, so there is a knowledge component to a False Claims Act action. So there's also the possibility of liability for deliberate ignorance or reckless disregard of the truthfulness of the information. But if you're complying in good faith, you know, the Shute case last year made clear that there's a subjective intent component here. If you're doing your best and if you're able to document that you intended to comply with the requirements, then there at least won't be an issue with fraud if, in fact, there is a breach, notwithstanding your efforts to comply.
All right. And tell us about something else you pointed out, the Justice Department's Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative that's been going on for several years now. It's kind of behind all this that could come and bite you.
Yes. So DOJ has been paying close attention. And of course, CMMC has been getting a lot of attention in this regard. And whenever there's a self-attestation requirement, there's heightened risk for the contractor because they're doing the assessment themselves that they're complying. So DOJ is particularly concerned, of course, because of the national security implications for the government if software isn't secure or if other cybersecurity requirements aren't met. That's the ultimate driver here. There was an executive order issued back in 2021 improving the nation's cybersecurity. And the federal government's concern is they need to be able to keep their own system secure. And to do that, the software that's being provided that they're using needs to be free from vulnerabilities. And there are concerns about knowing where all of the different code comes from. And so the Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative is certainly one tool that is likely to come into play to ensure that contractors are attesting accurately to meeting the security requirements.
And I guess that could be rough play if things go wrong for you. And you also note that in the rule, there are alternatives to attestation for some companies. What are those?
That's right. So if a software producer is going to comply but can't yet comply with the attestation requirements, maybe they're not meeting all of the required security practices, they can draft a plan of action and milestones, which is basically a corrective action type document that identifies the practices they can't attest to and documents the measures they have in place to mitigate the risks. And then they submit that to the agency or agencies that are using their software. And if the agency's satisfied with the POAM, then they can continue to use the software, but they have to request either an extension of the deadline from OMB or a waiver in order to be able to do that. And OMB is going to be monitoring agencies' use of POAMs and acceptance of POAMs beginning in June of this year. They're going to collect data and make sure that software producers aren't kind of abusing this and agencies aren't abusing the POAM mechanism and are making progress at least toward meeting all the requirements.
And it looks as if CISA did loosen the final rule a little bit versus how they proposed it, probably based on industry comments, but you found that it looks a little easier than it might have when it first proposed.
Yes, they did clarify the scope of attestation a little bit to be a little bit more fair to contractors. So the contractors are only attesting to the things that are actually within their control. And so one notable area on that is third-party components. And the final form adds language that says that software producers are only required to attest that they follow the secure software development practices for the code that they developed. And there's a specific carve out. So they're not attesting to third party producers of components following the practices. Now, they do have to follow their own precautions for incorporating third party components to mitigate the risk, maintaining trusted source code supply chains, using automated tools or other practices, and then maintaining provenance for internal code and third-party components to the greatest extent feasible. So they have to do some of their own homework to make sure that they are doing their best to avoid introducing vulnerabilities through third-party components, but they don't have to attest to those third parties following the same practices that they're required to attest to. And there's also a change in who is required to attest, which is helpful to contractors. The previous version of the form said that only the chief executive officer or the chief operating officer of the company was required to attest. And now there's an option for a designee of the company who's an employee and authorized to bind the company to sign the attestation instead of the CEO.
Yeah, can you imagine Satya Nadella of Microsoft, you know, being asked 30 times a day, hey, we've got another attestation for you, or Larry Ellison of Oracle. I don't think they're going to be spending too much time personally attesting.
Right. Well, and there were real concerns there, right? If your CEO is going to have to sign the attestation, even just doing the work to get them up to speed to understand the technical requirements, and then the level of documentation you would want to support that would be much more extensive. If you have someone who's technically savvy on your team, that gives you a greater level of comfort that they understand what they're attesting to.
All right. Dan Ramish is a procurement attorney with Haynes Boone. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
And we'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective, we get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're gonna go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions. And that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion. And then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture. And what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful? So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth, and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency, and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. You're, Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.